Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll fulfill a promise I made last week and talk about the sin of pride. Last week, in fact, I promised you a journey through the seven deadly sins. This isn't because I want to contemplate wickedness and create an atmosphere of fear and doom. Quite the contrary. Because each of the deadly sins is, at its root, a failure to love, by visiting each of them in turn we can learn how to love, or how to love better. I've chosen as our guide through all this Dante Alighieri, who is the poet of love. He is the poet of human love and divine love, and of how one love grows into the other. Dante's masterwork is the poem we call the Divine Comedy. It is an epic journey through the kingdoms of the dead, hell, purgatory, and heaven. In that sense, it is a speculation about life after death, but that's not all it is. It is at the same time an allegory describing life now, the states of mind, the states of soul that we all go through. By the way, it's also a brilliant adventure story and you can't put it down. I've picked Dante because he is the poet of love and he places the seven deadly sins at the exact centre of his poem. He sees them all in terms of love. Failures of love, yes, but the failure inspires us to love successfully. In the different deadly sins, he sees love of the wrong things, half-hearted love, and love excessive and uncontrolled. It wouldn't make sense just to parachute us into the story right in the middle of the poem, so this week I'm going to take us on fast forward all the way from the beginning. It is Maundy Thursday of the year 1300. Dante is 35, so if you remember the psalm which talks about 70 years, that puts him exactly halfway through his life. And he is lost. He has found himself in a dark wood and he is lost. There are no footpaths, only shadows and trees and undergrowth. In one direction there is a hill, and he knows he has to climb it. But there are wild beasts in the wood. There is a leopard, there is a lion, and there is a hungry she-wolf. Whichever way he tries to approach the hill, they are there in front of him, and he has to retreat. As he wanders, lost in the wood, Dante encounters a man. The man is the Roman poet Virgil. Virgil wrote the greatest epic poem in Roman literature, the Aeneid, which tells the story of the foundation of Rome. Dante the poet admired Virgil the poet more than any other poet. Dante the poet is about to try to rival Virgil the poet by constructing the first ever epic in Italian. The character Virgil in the story is going to be Dante in the story's guide down through hell and his companion through most of purgatory. Because, yes, the straight way up and out is blocked by those beasts, and now the only way up is by going down. The beasts represent the disorderly passions that can attack any of us. Virgil in the story is not only Virgil the poet, but also wisdom, fortitude, prudence, temperance, and justice, all the pagan virtues, that is, all the virtues you can have without knowing anything about God. There isn't much I need to say about their journey down through hell, except the one big thing we must never forget. Hell is not a punishment for not doing well enough, like failing an exam or something. Hell is what you want when you don't accept love and you don't accept God. When the only thing in the world that really truly matters to you deep down is you, yourself, then what you want is what you get. And what you want and what you get when you want nothing but me is hell. The poets go down then, down, down, down to the centre of the earth. That is to say, to the very bottom of the entire universe. Because in medieval cosmology, the earth was not the centre of the universe, but the bottom of it. And at the bottom is the ultimate worshipper in this religion of me, Satan himself. The thing about the worship of me is that everything that is not me is seen as the opposite of me, and therefore an enemy to be hated. For Satan, the ultimate self-worshipping me that makes everything an enemy, everything in the entire creation, and especially the Creator himself. Satan, in Dante, cannot even speak. Who would he speak to? All he can do is weep and drool. The poets climb down to the centre of the earth, and as they pass the centre, down becomes up. And just as they were climbing down, 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 so now they climb up, 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 until they come to the surface in the southern hemisphere, exactly on the other side of the earth, on an island 4,000 miles high, Mount Purgatory. On the horizon they see two small white things. Then the white things get a little bigger and closer together. Then they join up. They are the wings of an angel steering a boat, and in the boat are the souls of the dead coming to purgatory to be cleaned up and made ready for heaven. From now on, every single soul Dante meets is bound for heaven. There is no doubt about it. Some of them will be clean and light and pure already, and they will be in heaven in next to no time. Some of them will be heavily encrusted with vices and bad habits, but in the end they must have made the final choice for God and for happiness, or they wouldn't be here in purgatory. They will have to be scrubbed clean, and the scrubbing will hurt. But when they are clean at last, they will get what they deep down really always wanted, being at one with God in heaven. You may think it all sounds too easy. No need to worry about having a good life. Be as bad or uncontrolled or self-indulgent as you want. As long as you say sorry at the end, you're all right. Heaven is yours. And indeed, when our enemies aren't complaining that we scare everyone by stories of hell fire, they complain that we make everyone complacent by promising forgiveness to anyone who asks for it. Somehow we have to believe both at once. We have the Gospel's warning that if your eye offends you, pluck it out. Better to have one eye in heaven than two eyes in eternal damnation. But we also know that God's love and mercy are infinite. That arithmetic needs some thinking about, but let's get on with the story. The poets have got a third of the way up Mount Purgatory. They follow a narrow, twisting crack up the mountain. They come to a gate with three stone steps leading to it. These are the three steps of confession. The first step is polished white marble. You look down at it and see yourself reflected as you really are. The second is black and rough, cracked up and down and left to right so as to make the sign of a cross. Your sadness and contrition at your sinful state. The third is made of porphyry, a blood-red rock, Christ's blood poured out for your healing. By the gate is an angel with a sword. With his sword, on Dante's forehead, he cuts seven times the letter P for peccatum or sin, one for each of the seven deadly sins. Dante and Virgil carry on up, and they reach a terrace. It is the terrace of pride, and it runs all the way round the mountain. So now at last we can start our story. Before they turn to walk along the terrace, the poets see three scenes carved in the rock in front of them to such perfection that everything in them seems alive. The scenes show the opposite of pride. One scene shows the Ark of the Covenant being brought into Jerusalem. King David dances in delight in front of it. He leaps and he dances in nothing but the linen loincloth priests use at sacrifice. Michal, the daughter of Saul, watches David cavorting in front of all the people in this undignified way, and she despises him. "What an unking-like thing to do," she says. But David has no need to be admired by anyone, and for him the dignity and respectability of kingship mean nothing compared to the thanks he wants to give the Lord in every way he can. David has no pride. Another scene is a medieval legend. The Roman Emperor Trajan is off to the wars with all his army when a poor widow stops him and asks him to give judgment for her and punish the men who killed her son. "When I come back," he says. "What if you don't come back?" she asks. "Then my successor will do it." Why should your successor do his duty if you don't do yours? So Trajan stops with all his army and hears the widow's case, because an emperor, being the ruler of all, must be the servant of all. Trajan is not proud. The third scene is the Annunciation, and you think, yes, Mary was humble and not proud. That's true, but surely the humility was on the other side as well. God is God, but God had the humility to become man for our sake. God is not proud. After all this inspiration to give up pride, Dante looks and sees the proud themselves, the people whose lives had been dominated by pride. They must have put their pride to one side enough to say yes to God, or they wouldn't be here. But still, their pride is a fact about them, and pride gets in the way of everything, and so they have to be healed of it. The proud are a line of people walking slowly along the terrace. They have to walk slowly because they are carrying heavy weights on their backs. They are bent double under those loads, and Dante gets a sore back and a stiff neck just from looking at them. In purgatory there are sufferings, but they are curative rather than punitive. I suppose the load of pride one carries round and round that first terrace gets less as one becomes more and more cleansed of the pride. The sufferings are appropriate to the sin. If you think about it, pride of the look at me, aren't I splendid kind, pride of the don't you know who I am kind, is a weight and a burden, and the greater the pride, the heavier the weight is. You could put it like this: the higher you are, the harder you fall, and every time you puff yourself up to a greater height, you are only setting yourself up for a greater fall. Here's a story. Once upon a time I was asked to a garden party, and I went to it, and I found I knew nobody. I expect that's happened to you at some time or another. I drifted vaguely around until I found myself among some people clustered round someone I can only describe as an alpha male. He was so sure that he was better than everyone else that he didn't need to emphasize it. Everyone believed he was. He was very tall and very wide and a rugby player, and I bet he had some sort of top job in the city. Universal domination. Now it also emerged that he enjoyed reading theology, so I got talking to him, and in the course of the conversation I mentioned that I was practicing Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I was new to the sport at the time, so it tended to creep into all my conversations. Now clearly, an alpha male cannot not be interested in any kind of sport. Universal domination, you see. So he expressed interest, and I, not understanding the rules yet, thought that his expression of interest meant he was interested. So I said, why not come along and try a class? I was interested too, actually. There was already someone his size in the class, and I rather looked forward to what might happen when they met. Universal domination? An alpha male cannot decline any sort of challenge, so he said yes, because he couldn't say anything else. By the time the date of the class came round, I had finally worked out the situation. On the one hand, if he didn't turn up, how could he live with himself for chickening out? On the other hand, if he did turn up and didn't smash this new sport first time of trying, how could he live with himself for being such a loser? I had acted with perfect innocence throughout. There was no malice within me at all, but I was curious to see how he would deal with the situation. And now you see what I mean about heavy burdens being an apt image for pride. He was bent double under the weight of being who he was. To complete the story, somehow he happened to have to stay late at work that evening, so he arrived halfway through the class. It wasn't worth joining in then, he said, so he just watched. Honour preserved. We never did get round to talking about theology. On a smaller scale, we have all of us been held back from doing things by a fear of making fools of ourselves, which is one of the commonest manifestations of the sin of pride. For most people, this sort of pride is a surface kind of thing, and it doesn't do real harm. But like all the deadly sins, it can creep inwards and take us over and in the end there is nothing of us left. All sin is like that. Now Dante classifies pride as a form of love perverted, meaning that it is a love of one's neighbour's harm, because pride means one doesn't want any rivals. But I think one can go deeper. I think pride can be classified as love inadequate or love misunderstood, and classifying it like that makes us understand better what loving is. Here's what I mean. The commandments tell us we must love ourselves. To be precise, they say, love your neighbour as yourself, and if you didn't love yourself, that commandment wouldn't mean anything. There is more than one kind of love, and one of them isn't really love at all. One of the ways I can love you is by loving you purely and simply because you are, to love you because you are you. The other way of loving, at least we give it the name loving, is to love you for a reason. I love my love with an A because she's angelic. I love my love with a B because he is brave. What this I love my love because is saying is, my love is a conditional love. To say I love you because is to say I love you if. If you are angelic, I love you, if not, not. Love if is not real love at all. It is love not of the person, only of certain facts about the person. You can see how love if isn't real love if you look at the vows we exchange at marriage, which are vows about real love because they have to be. Those vows take every fact about me that might make you love me, health, wealth, being nice to be around, and commit you to loving me even if they all disappear tomorrow. For richer, for poorer, you say, in sickness and in health. Now, how many people are capable of living up to the full implications of that vow is a tricky question, but that is what the vow says, and love, real love, is why it says it. Thus, in the story of our poor alpha friend, and to be honest, the story of you and me at many times in our lives, pride comes when self-love is imperfect. Our alpha friend had got used to loving himself because he was big, loving himself because he was strong, loving himself because he was good at things. But love because, love because, love because, boils down in the end to love if, love if, love if, and that carries with it the threat that if the because is absent. If for even a moment there is a deficiency of size, of strength, of skill, then there will be no self-love, no self-respect, there will be nothing. That is why the proud protect themselves so. That is why pride is such a weight on them, and why Dante uses heavy weights as an image of pride in purgatory. Pride is a prison whose bars are made out of the idea of love if. The acid which will dissolve the bars is made out of love without the if. Perhaps the easiest way to make your escape is to turn the commandment back to front. You know you are commanded to love your neighbour as yourself. Well then, set out to love yourself the way you love your neighbour. You love your neighbour, or ought to, irrespective of any qualities your neighbour may or may not possess. So try to love yourself the same way. Another exercise I know people have found helpful is this. God made the universe. Out of all the possible universes that God might have made, he made this particular one, and he looked at it, and he saw that it was good. God could have made a universe which, as human beings went on for generation after generation, never included your existence. God chose not to do that. God chose to make a universe in which sooner or later you would appear. This means that to fail to love yourself, or to love yourself only on certain conditions, is to disrespect God's choice, so don't do it. I've talked about someone who was a prisoner of pride. I don't know if he escaped it or if it took him over. Let me finish with the story of a friend of mine who did escape. My friend was intelligent and well-educated. She wore all her learning lightly because it was a joy to her. Her conversation sparkled, and when it sparkled, to be with her was a delight. But she chose for herself a very dangerous career. Her progress through life, her success, depended entirely on her being good at everything, being more expert than anyone, knowing more important people than anyone else did. You might summarize by saying it had to be alpha or nothing. Her career depended on it. Gradually the pride soaked into her, and it became harder and harder for her to remember the young, carefree woman she once was. It became harder for her to be that person even when she was among friends and it was safe to do so. In the end, God saved her the only way he could. First he gave her disaster, and then when that wasn't enough, he gave her death. I shan't go into the manner of her dying, except to say that it was slow and it was medical, but it was a beautiful time, because Jesus was with her, Jesus the vine dresser who prunes the vines. Cut is the branch that might have grown full straight, says the chorus at the end of Dr. Faustus. Well, this particular branch had grown crooked. The only thing to be done was to prune it to make it ready for eternity. So that's what God did. Through the days and weeks, as my friend lay dying, the vine dresser cut away a little here, a little there. He separated the inessential from the essential. He unwound the dead tendrils and freed the live stems of the vine. The operation was intricate, but the vine dresser is loving and skilled, and his pruning hook is sharp. One day, when I visited my friend in hospital, I took one look at her and said, "You're back!" And because she was back, she knew exactly what I meant. The branch was free again. Its dead wood had been cut away, and it was free to wave in the breeze and rejoice once more in the sunlight and grow leaves again. It was ready for heaven. Dante and Virgil leave the terrace of pride, blessed by an angel who says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." As the angel says those words, Dante feels himself to be lighter, so much so that climbing the stair to the next terrace feels just like walking on the flat. The first of the seven P's has been wiped from his forehead. As each of the sins is purged, he will feel lighter still, and the climb will become easier and easier. So it is also with our own sins. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.